A dash of tax policy, a little bit of gentrification, and some burglary thrown in. Yeah, sounds like a show to me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here, everybody. It is Tuesday, the 5th of April. Inversion. It's a noun, says Merriam-Webster, the act of inverting something or the state of being inverted, or as this guy says, something more tax policy-like.
Simply put, in layman's terms, it's when big corporations acquire small companies and then change their address to another country on paper in order to get out of paying their fair share of taxes here at home.
President Obama took to the podium for a quick victory lap today following the Treasury Department's decision to make it harder, not impossible, but harder for American companies to do those tax inversions. The widely acknowledged proximate cause for the Treasury's decision is the proposed merger slash inversion between the big pharma companies Pfizer and Allergan. But we thought it might be a good idea to take a step back for just a second here and provide a little tax policy context on this whole thing. Marketplace's Annie Baxter starts us off.
When a U.S. company merges with a foreign firm in an inversion, executives, workers, and facilities often stay put. The headquarters move occurs mostly on paper.
It is simply changing its legal address.
Frank Clementi is executive director of Americans for Tax Fairness. He says under an inversion, a U.S. firm no longer pays U.S. taxes on its global income. It is still on the hook for income generated in the U.S. But big multinationals, especially tech and drug companies with valuable patents, can make profits look like they're generated elsewhere.
The drug or the computer software may be invented here in America, but the ownership gets shifted offshore to a tax haven. So the income is being generated mostly in the tax haven in the future, not here in America.
He says U.S. multinationals have more than $2 trillion in profits parked or deferred overseas. Inversions put a growing share out of Uncle Sam's reach, and they allow companies to move money around to lower whatever remaining U.S. tax bill they might still have. Steve Rosenthal is with the Tax Policy Center. He says companies invert to boost profits and shareholder value, which is all totally legal.
No corporation is obliged to run its affairs to maximize the taxes it pays the U.S. government, just like none of us are obliged.
However, he says, someone has to pay for stuff like roads and schools, and that's why the rest of us should care. When big multinationals pay less in taxes, the rest of us have to pay more, or the government does less. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
A politician whose name most of us had never heard 48 hours ago has offered to step aside. Sigmundur David Gunnlaugsson is the soon-to-be former prime minister of Iceland, the first clear political casualty of the Panama Papers. But you dig into those papers just a little bit, the ones released this weekend outlining the amazing array of offshore tax and cash havens for the rich and powerful among us. You dig into them and something catches your eye. A list of the most popular places where people mentioned in the leaks stash their money. There are, of course, the usual suspects, the British Virgin Islands, the Bahamas and Panama. Also, Nevada. Yes, that Nevada, as in Vegas and Reno, Elephant Rock and the like. It and other American states have become tax havens of their own in the past couple of years. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that one.
Above all, tax dodgers want their money where it can't be seen. Michelle Hanlon specializes in understanding their moves as an accounting professor at MIT's business school.
Wherever there's more secrecy afforded, that's where they will want to be.
And lately, U.S. states like Nevada and Delaware have started to offer relatively more secrecy than historic tax havens. Think Swiss bank accounts or tiny Caribbean countries. That's in part because of a U.S. push to get banks around the world to share more info about Americans with money abroad. That led the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development to come out with pretty tough international disclosure standards. Nearly every major country signed on, but not one really important one.
The United States actually ranks with Panama in refusing to sign up to that multilateral standard. And that's why a lot of people are saying the U.S. is the new big tax haven.
Alex Cobham directs research for the Tax Justice Network, which tracks and criticizes havens. As other countries tightened rules, a handful of American states became globally famous for making it easy for anyone to quickly and quietly form a company.
Those states, including Delaware and Wyoming and Nevada, make a good deal of money from selling that service.
Of course, there are plenty of lawful reasons people would want to start a U.S. company, and states here are free to compete for their business. But the swift secrecy they provide also makes it possible for the bad folks to use that legal service to illegally evade taxes. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today traders were underwhelmed, I guess might be a good word. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You don't actually have to be in New York, as I've been the past couple of days, to know that real estate prices in this city are bananas. With those valuations, though, come business opportunities, specifically in parts of the city that haven't yet seen the housing spike. And predominantly, those gains come at the expense of people who, in a lot of cases, have lived there for generations. Gentrification is what we're talking about here in Brooklyn, to be precise. It's the subject of a new podcast series from WNYC. It's called There Goes the Neighborhood. It's hosted by Kai Wright. He's an editor at The Nation magazine. It's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start, I guess, with the housing market in Brooklyn. There are really two markets, right? There's the tippy top where everything's fine, and then there's the almost the entire rest of it where things are terrible, you say.
That's correct. It really is a tale of two cities. And in this way, it's kind of a great metaphor for where we're at in the national economy generally. And so at the top of the housing market, it is booming to historic perspectives. There's just money rushing in, building booms happening, people are making record profits, and so much so that they'll continue to build even when there's an oversupply because the return is going to be so high when they finally sell. At the bottom end of the market, which is growing, there is a massive and historic shortage. Prices are far out of reach for average both renters and homeowners. And it's actually a literal state of emergency in the city. And so people are up in arms about that. Mm. People are feeling anxious and angry and scared.
And you know, the thing about Brooklyn is, for all the grief it's gotten in the past 10 or 15 years about brand Brooklyn and hipsters and all of that, it has always been a place where new arrivals to this country go, where lower income people can go, where they can live and have a place. And it's just not that anymore because of gentrification and what's happening.
Well, that is what is at stake very much. There still remains plenty of people here who are working class, who are new immigrants, who are new migrants from around the country also, right? You know, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. And so there are still people trying to do that, but it has very much been put at risk specifically because of housing. I mean, certainly to buy a home in Brooklyn, the median income is $46,000. The median home price is $700,000. It's just out of control. Sure. And then as a consequence, that trickles down to the rental market.
Yeah. So the idea, though, and just to give you a poke in the eye here, the idea that money is coming into New York City, that people are trying to get more for their buck, and the lower end of this of the income spectrum is getting squeezed out, that can't possibly come as surprising news.
Well, it's the scale at which it's happening is the thing. The question is, what does government do to try to regulate and control that market such that the city can still be a place where you can have multiple income tiers and where you can have both racial and cultural diversity that you need in order to have the vibrant city that we all love? So the question is not whether or not the New York's housing market is attracting money. It always has. The question is whether or not we are doing enough in the public sector to try to balance that such that it's a livable city still.
Well, right. And one of the things that we found when we were doing York and Fig at Marketplace, our series on gentrification, and one of the things that's in the first episode of There Goes in the Neighborhood is the idea that gentrification doesn't just happen. There are market forces behind it. There are developers who come in. There are realtors. There are people, speculators, who come in and with intent move people out so that they can move in.
Well, absolutely. Listen, so my partner and I are shopping for a home in Brooklyn right now. We are shopping on the far edge in East New York in Cypress Hills, and we are going to open houses. We are the only end users that we have seen at any of the open houses. It's us and a bunch of developers. And in the 3 months that we have been shopping, the price point has gone up $300,000 because that neighborhood has now been identified as the place where you can get these huge returns. And so the money is flooding in. And whether or not a plan to control that or to build affordable housing alongside that can work really is a question of speed.
It's a new podcast series from WNYC. It's called There Goes the Neighborhood. Kai Wright hosts it. He's also with The Nation magazine. Kai, thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
It's weird, man, saying Kai, thanks very much. It's very weird.
It really was. It's kind of weird. You ought to check out the series our Wealth and Poverty Desk did on gentrification in Los Angeles, too.
It's called, as I said, York and Fig. You can go to our website, marketplace.org. All the way on the left-hand side is that link that says Mentioned on Air. How many times have you thought to yourself, all right, I am done watching Thursday Night Football on the big TV in my living room. I wish I could just watch it on that tiny screen that I can hold in the palm of my hand. Not your cup of tea, perhaps, but Twitter is hoping there is a bunch of people who are going to be interested in doing that. According to the NFL, the social media firm has signed a deal with the league to stream 10 Thursday Night Football games this season. Exact terms weren't disclosed, but the price tag is reported to have been about $10 million, plus or minus. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has the whys and wherefores.
Twitter likes to point out that there are more than twice as many people who see tweets as the number of people who are active tweeters, people who sign up for an account and sign in on Twitter. The company is trying to change that statistic, says James McQuivey, a tech analyst at Forrester Research.
Twitter's problem is to try and convert some of that general brand awareness that people have of the Twitter brand into actual behavior.
This is a big challenge for Twitter. At the end of 2015, its active user base shrunk for the first time. So the company has been focusing on its strengths, says James Chalkmok. He's an internet equity research analyst at Maness, Crespi, and Hart.
The way that Twitter is positioning itself right now is to be synonymous with all things live. And when you think about sports, there's nothing more live and engaging than that.
So Chalkmok says watching a football game live makes sense on Twitter. The company also owns the live streaming app Periscope, which will have pregame videos from teams and players. Viewers won't need to sign up or sign in to watch. And that's a big change for the NFL.
This is innovative. It's new.
Rodney Ford, a professor of sports management at the University of Michigan, says the NFL is transitioning into a digital future.
If people are beginning to move away from the usual cable relationship, then all of these other ways are going to be important future revenue streams for all pro sports leagues.
Ford says leagues are trying to figure out how to reach fans directly by going where the eyeballs are online. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There's everything from a burglar in Maryland who was known for breaking into one townhouse and then carving through the drywall into the next townhouse.
Architecture and the criminal mind straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 133 points today, about 0.75%, 17,603 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 47 points, 0.9%, 48.43. The S&P 500 shaved off 20 points, 1%, 2,045. The Treasury Department's anti-inversion plan we told you about. Botox maker Allergan sagged 14.7% today. Pfizer boosted itself 2% higher. Ford Motor Company announced today it's going to build more small cars in Mexico. That's starting in 2018. Ford nonetheless sputtered 0.2%. General Motors down 1% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.72%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Today was a good day for the oil-producing countries of the earth. Crude prices in New York closed up. Not a lot, but up just shy of $36 a barrel. There is no country that needs oil to bounce back more than Venezuela does. The economy there is almost entirely dependent on drilling and selling, but it's a petroeconomy that has, by all accounts, mismanaged the resource horribly. It sits on the largest proven reserves in the world, Venezuela does, yet it produces just a quarter of what Saudi Arabia and Russia do. A study this year, in fact, said it is the most miserable economy on the planet. Marketplace's Scott Tong is just back from a couple of weeks in Venezuela and brought with him this latest installment of his occasional series, Resource Curse.
There's a quote about Venezuela and oil that plays over and over in my head, so I'm going to play it for you. It's from oil economist Carlos Mendoza Potella.
We are condemned. They say we have oil for 500 years, so we're doomed to keep suffering from this disease.
Doomed? Disease? How can a place win the natural resource lottery and still lose? One place to start unwinding this paradox is downtown Caracas. On this pedestrian-only shopping street, the middle class is still buying clothes, shoes, books, phones. They have a saying here, it's cheap, I'll buy two. Venezuelans have become spoiled by oil, says historian Miguel Tinker Salas at Pomona College.
It is the lubricant that fuels the economy, and it pervades every aspect of society, creating an artificial sense of expectation and of entitlement.
So let's go back briefly to the start of the oil age here. The big gusher came in 1922. The Barroso Well No. 2 spewed as much crude as the famed Spindletop Well in East Texas 2 decades prior.
And that really introduces Venezuela into the period of modern oil production. By the 1923-24, the U.S. is involved. So you have two large conglomerates eventually coming out of this process, which is the Shell and eventually Standard Oil Company of New Jersey.
The Americans brought Christmas trees and hot dogs and baseball and terminology.
El cacheo, that means catch the ball when you're playing baseball. El cacheo. Tipeando means typing. Overales, that means overalls. Payroll, that means payroll.
By 1929, Venezuela was the world's top oil exporter. But as often happens in petrostates, oil shoved aside the other sectors. Farmers stopped growing coffee and cocoa beans. They moved to cities built with oil money. Again, economist Potella.
Cada gobierno formula planes.
Every government that comes to Venezuela brings a new plan to develop agriculture and the industrial sector, but they fail.
They did try, but manufacturing was hard. So many oil dollars flooded in that Venezuela's exports got expensive. They got uncompetitive.
The Ford Motor Company.
We brought Ford to Venezuela, Toyota to Venezuela, but they only made a few parts, not the core of the car. Industrialization was cosmetic.
As Venezuela went all in on oil, prices went bust in the 1950s. One oil minister wondered out loud about a curse, says historian Tinker Salas.
He was coming to the conclusion, as many have in Venezuela, that oil was not simply a gift from God, but in fact had become this excrement of the devil.
The excrement of the devil. So to try to prevent future busts, Caracas joined big oil producers in the Middle East in 1960. They agreed not to overproduce and to form a group, OPEC. Now, OPEC helped to keep prices high in the 1970s, which was bad for America, very good for Venezuela.
We had the Concorde in Caracas connecting us to Paris. Venezuelans traveled abroad regularly, bought property in Florida, were part of this elite class.
In the middle of this boom, the country nationalized oil. It bought out international firms like Shell and Mobil and formed a government-owned company to control all the drilling. It's known by the acronym PDVSA. I went to PDVSA headquarters in downtown Caracas and asked for an interview. The answer, no. Now, in the 80s and 90s, PDVSA was a world-class company. It had top global talent, it had foreign partners, investors. It planned to double oil production to 6 million barrels every day. And then Hugo Chavez changed everything.
Rumor de clarine, guerrero.
The socialist president won election in 98. His administration spent almost all the country's oil money and didn't save much. He clashed with PDVSA, calling it a black box controlled by foreigners. PDVSA workers went on strike in 2002 against Chavez. Here's Russ Dallin of Caracas Capital Markets.
So he fired them, 20,000 to 30,000 people, and replaced them with people who were politically loyal to him.
Ever since, PDVSA has morphed into an all-purpose arm of the government. Its revenues fund the government. The company now runs convenience stores. It grows soybeans, and it makes shoes. It hired 100,000 workers that Russ Dallin calls
managerially inept.
Refinery worker Ivan Freites is secretary of the Oil Workers Union.
Hugo Chavez transformed PDVSA from something profitable into something he could take money out of, and he made it political.
He says PDVSA ignored maintenance of oil facilities and safety. 4 years ago, one refinery exploded, killing 42 people.
They did not buy workers' security gear or protective equipment. In some places, PDVSA hasn't given out safety gloves in 2 years.
It gets worse. Venezuela's newest oil is really thick. They call it extra heavy. But PDVSA hasn't built enough facilities to process it, so the company has to dilute it with light sweet crude, imported lately from the U.S., of all places. Mismanagement of oil, the only thing Venezuela really makes, has pushed production to less than half of the national target. And now prices have gone bust, leading more people to recycle that line about oil and the devil's excrement. In Caracas, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Next time you have a chance, look up at the buildings around you and think about what you see. The windows and the doors, what kind of roof the building has, maybe. Chances are you're not thinking about the easiest way to rob the place, but others are, burglars and thieves. Jeff Mano has spent some time trying to get into those criminals' heads, architecturally speaking, and he's written about it in a new book called A Burglar's Guide to the City. Jeff, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Why a book on burglary in the city and all of that?
Well, I'm an architecture and design writer, and I just noticed over the years of covering cities and buildings that some of the most interesting and actually creative approaches to the built environment were actually coming from the world of crime. When you look at how burglars look at the built environment, the kinds of vulnerabilities, the kind of blind spots, how they move even from room to room, it just seemed that there needed to be some sort of architectural introduction to burglary or a burglar's guide to the city.
Give me a for instance. What stuck out to you in your research?
Sure. There's everything from a burglar in Maryland who was known for breaking into one townhouse and then carving through the drywall into the next townhouse, then going through the drywall into the next townhouse. There was a gang in Los Angeles, in fact, actually, who broke into a bank from below. It remains unsolved. And they came in using the sewer system in June of 1986.
Is there a thing that we can do? I mean, we have to live in this built environment, right? We have to live in these cities. We just have to get used to it, right? We just have to, you know, criminals are going to figure this out. Robbers are going to figure this out. And we just have to deal with it.
Yeah, it's kind of part of the DNA of the modern metropolis where criminals are finding ways into our buildings. So we respond by getting things like timers on our lights or extra locks on the front door. And it's this endless arms race that's been going on for centuries and if not even millennia. Part of my book goes back to ancient Rome and talking about the prevalence of urban crime in that era.
Even back to Paris in the 17th century and this whole idea of the city of light is criminally based.
Yeah, that really blew me away that when we refer to Paris as the city of light, it sounds so romantic and it sounds like this really beautiful image of urban cooperation and hope. But in fact, it was a 17th century police operation that led to the nickname when the king ordered the streetlights to be installed.
Talk to me for a minute about L.A., because there was a big excerpt in the New York Times Magazine a couple of weeks ago, obviously a big section in the book, about L.A. and how it is influenced and influences crime in the pursuit thereof or burglaries in the pursuit thereof.
Sure. Yeah. LA is a really interesting example where you have a transportation decision that was made, which was to crisscross the city with freeways and then give that enough time and people figure out alternative ways of using those freeways. And so LA, of course, is already widely known for high speed car chases.
Yeah.
But another side effect that all the freeways had was that you had these things developing called stop and robs. And so it's basically a bank, a credit union or any business that's at the bottom of an off ramp and at the bottom of an on ramp. They can just pull off the freeway and then race their way to freedom, you know, minutes later. And so Los Angeles in that way had this peculiar ability to sort of instigate a crime wave in the 1990s where L.A. became, you know, the bank robbery capital of the world. There was a bank robbery of every 45 minutes of every workday.
Wow. Police obviously are responding to this in sort of a hacker and victim kind of way, right? I mean, the criminals are always innovating and the cops are having to, you know, chase them and catch up.
They are, but there's a lot of innovation on the side of the police as well. There's a really fascinating program that I cover in the book that it was coming out of England, actually. It's called the Capture House Program. And so the police have actually developed these fake apartments where they're filled with, you know, laptops and cameras and expensive gear, but everything's covered with forensic coatings and UV-detected liquids and that kind of stuff. So that, you know, if you break in, you'll be caught on camera and you'll be covered in this glowing liquid.
In this digital age, it's interesting that there is still so much physical theft and robbery.
Yeah, that's what I really like about this is that it engages with architecture in a really hands-on pretty lo-fi way. And I think it's important to be reminded that even though people seem to be switching to cybercrime and hacking and identity theft, there still is this risk of real physical breaking and entering.
Jeff Mano, the book is called A Burglar's Guide to the City. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that there is a person in the Marketplace Bureau here in New York who's going to see Hamilton tonight for the second time, even though some of us haven't seen it once. Anyway, I mentioned that so I could pass this along. I'm not bitter at all. There's a story coming in the New York Times Magazine this weekend about the lead producer of the blockbuster show about this country's first Treasury Secretary and the challenges of managing a runaway hit like Hamilton is. Here is just one line item. That show is averaging a profit of more than $500,000 a week. Not throwing away my shot, indeed. Holy cow, we're late. I got to go. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.